the Healthy Mind Podcast, episode number 80. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice. Our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Well, hi everybody, it's Dr. Zafiridis. Welcome to The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Well, hope you had a good week. I have a jam-packed show for you this week. Have you ever tried to exercise and just didn't work out? Or you're on a diet and you need to lose weight and it just falls through? Why don't we change? Why don't we change? This week on The Healthy Mind, this was really inspired by a study that I had seen. I actually posted the news piece on The Healthy Mind, Why Are We Resistant to Change? And you can find that there on the website. But this week, I really want to talk about habits. Why do we have these habits? Some good, but some bad. And why is it so hard to change our habits? What is going on here? And I think the secret to successful change of habits is understanding, knowledge, but really understanding what is going on in our mind, both in terms of the emotional part of it, but literally, physically, what is going on in our minds to start a habit up into place. And once we know how that happens, that arms us with a lot of knowledge on how to change it. So we're going to be talking about that. You're going to see how our mind actually works to make a behavior a habit, and then what we can do to change it. So I'm going to give you what I hope are some really helpful tips. They've helped me in terms of being able to change those behaviors, to really achieve what you want to, and really move from wishing you could make a change to making that change. So the psychology of habits here on The Healthy Mind. In news, some really very, very interesting news. Researchers out of Vanderbilt University have identified a new potential way to treat anxiety, stress, and depression. Really fascinating what they found. We'll talk about that in the second half of the podcast. And also, did you sleep well last night? Well, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, would you believe that your brain changes? The biology of your brain changes with insomnia, and it can explain why you are craving that pepperoni pizza or that cheeseburger. How insomnia leads to pizza cravings. We'll do some headlines, and heck, we have ourselves a great podcast this week. I am so happy you're here. So, if you're ready, let's begin. Okay, well, we're talking about habits this week on The Healthy Mind. I mean, how many of us have been there, right? This is the week that I start exercising, or this is the week I'm going to start that diet. And then what happens? Well, life happens, right? And we don't make those changes. Now, we can be even more serious for so many people. Problems that begin to happen with alcohol and drug addiction, porn addiction. These habits get into place And it is almost impossible, or at least we feel like it's impossible, to change our behavior. Why does this happen? And how are some people so much better, it seems, at being able to change their habits and move towards positive change in their lives and success, and others get mired in these habits? We know that some of these behaviors aren't good for us, but we almost feel like we are powerless. Why does this happen? And I think the most important part in understanding habits and making change in our behavior, the secret here is knowledge. And it's knowledge in the sense that we need to understand how our brain actually works. How is it that these behaviors form? What's going on? How are the odds sometimes stacked against us? And then how can we empower ourselves, load the odds in our favor to making positive and important change and getting rid of some of those negative behaviors that drain us and make us tired and just tug and bring down our self-esteem? So what I want to talk about a little bit first is your brain on habits, okay? Let's kind of peer into our brain and understand what's going on here as behaviors form. And to do this, you really go back not that far, back in the 1990s, and these were researchers at MIT. And what they found was that as we learn a behavior, it occurs in a certain part of our brain, but then as it becomes a habit, it then goes to a different part of the brain and gets stored there. So what am I talking about here? And what I want you to think of is, say when you've bought a computer, maybe a laptop or something, you want to make sure you get as much memory, right? RAM. Because that's the kind of memory you need to have your computer just chugging along, right? But it doesn't store a whole lot of memory. That'll go to a different part of the computer, but you need that RAM for speed, right? So when we engage in a new behavior, that is going to be in a different part of our brain. It's kind of in the newer brain, if you will, a part of the brain known as the cerebral cortex, kind of the outer parts of our brain, the part that really makes us human. Well, what these researchers found out was after a while, as we start getting used to that behavior and we're doing it over and over and over, like taking a shower, tying our shoes, driving to work, the behavior moves from that cortex area of our brain into a more primitive part of the brain known as the basal ganglia. It moves away from one part of the brain to the next, and in doing so, it frees up our cortex, the newer part of our brain, to do other activities. So this stuff is now happening in the background. And because of that, it becomes very pattern behavior that we almost don't pay attention to. And I think all of us can relate to that. If you've driven to work today or have gone somewhere that you know where you're going, it's not uncommon in the morning to get in your car and the next thing you know, you're either in the parking garage or you're in your office and you really haven't even thought about how you've gotten there, right? All of that is automatic and in the background. And what happens is it moves. So it literally moves to another part of the brain that now is reinforced. And what the researchers found was once it's there, it's there. It tends not to go away. The behavior is there. You can modify it, but those habits, those behaviors sit there like a loop. Now, the good news is we can modify that loop. We just have to understand the component parts of a habit and where kind of to precisely go in so that we're able to change it. And a lot of this information came from a fascinating book, The Power of Habit, that I've come across, and I can't tell you what a beautiful book this is. But as we understand the habit loop, what is it? Basically, there's a cue, some kind of trigger. Say you want to go get a Coca-Cola in the middle of the day, right? I'm thirsty, I'm tired, I'm whatever it may be, but you feel that. You do your behavior, walk over to the vending machine, plunk in your money, and boom, you get your Coke, and you get the reward. I got my Coke. I love the way it tastes. I feel refreshed. Okay, pretty straightforward, right? But here's where it gets interesting. Let's keep using that analogy of the Coca-Cola that you're getting. When you get that cue, no matter what it is, maybe I'm thirsty, maybe I'm tired, whatever it may be, your brain runs ahead and already pictures how awesome that Coke is going to taste. It literally provides you with the pleasure, even though you haven't gotten the reward yet. So what happens now is you've got this conflict. You've got this reward that you're feeling, this pleasure. And you've also got the cue, but there hasn't been any behavior yet. And scientists call this cognitive dissonance. And it is very, very powerful. And it's this paradox between I've got the pleasure, I've got the cue, I haven't done the behavior yet, and kind of like air going into a vacuum, we do the behavior almost unconsciously. So in essence, we get the craving, we get the pleasure, we haven't done something, so the brain makes us do that. But in this, there are three parts here that we have to look at in the habit. The cue, the trigger that tells your brain to go into automatic mode, the routine that you do, that behavior, which is in automatic mode, and then the reward. What helps your brain to make sure some habits are important and others are not? And that's the essence here. Here is the secret, if you will, in understanding how to change habits. We can begin to literally change either the cue or the reward, and the behavior, what happens in the middle, will change. What do we do? How do we manipulate this? Well, first off, there's a few steps to this, and it's a bit of a process. First off, let me just say, this doesn't happen overnight. We have to be patient. Sometimes we can be very motivated, perhaps because of negative consequences. People who are smoking, they're told they've got lung cancer and they can stop right away, right? But what's happened there is that reward has changed dramatically to something very scary. So the cue doesn't work anymore, the trigger, because the reward, all you're thinking of is lung cancer. So you don't smoke anymore, right? But we can make these changes. They take a little bit of time, but all of us can do it. That's the important part here. No matter what the behavior you're trying to change, it's going to involve some part of manipulating either the cue or the reward. So first off, one of the steps that we can take is identify the routine that you want to stop. What is it that you don't want to be doing? Let's say, using that Coca-Cola example, you don't like the fact that you've got to spend a couple dollars every day, or that it's causing you to gain weight. You don't like the idea that there's that much sugar, but you can't help yourself. You just want to have that Coke. So in this case, the routine that you want to change might be, I want to stop drinking Coke in the middle of the day. Now, what you have to do here is really don't worry about the routine. Like I said, if you can adjust the cue and the reward, the behavior will take care of itself. But first off, you want to experiment to find out what is the real reward. In the case of the Coke, is it really the Coke? Is it really that I love the way that tastes and I feel refreshed? Or is it because I can take a break, or that I feel tired and I feel like I want some caffeine? Figure out what the reward really is. Okay, so after you've identified the routine, you want to experiment with your reward to find out what is the real craving there. Okay, to make that clear, let's keep with this Coke analogy, right? For me, I crave a Coke around 2 o'clock because I like the way it tastes. But is it really that? Is it that you want that because you like the way it tastes, or I'm tired around 2 o'clock and the Coke makes me feel better because it gives me a caffeine jolt? Or around 2 o'clock, I'm starting to get bored and it lets me kind of walk around, talk to people, and I get that Coke. So you have to experiment with the reward to find out what is the real issue. And the way you might do that is if you feel that craving coming for the soda, take a walk, do a little bit of exercise, go and talk to people at work and see if that works. Give yourself about 10 or 15 minutes. Come back, see if you still have that craving. If it's something other than the Coca-Cola, say it's because you're tired, walking around, giving yourself a little exercise, you'll go back and you'll find that you don't have that craving for that soda anymore. So we start to adjust and figure out what is the craving, the real craving, that is tied to that reward. Now, the next step on this is identifying the triggers, the cues, okay? Realize that's a little bit later here. You would think, well, the first thing I've got to do is figure out those triggers about what gets me to go down this road. But it really is important to find out first, why do I go to that reward? What's the real reason? Because the triggers that start that craving are not as important as understanding the real reason why I'm craving something, or the real triggers to starting a certain behavior. But you do want to identify it. And according to the Power of Habit, there are essentially five different categories of cues that most people will find serve as triggers for these behaviors. It can be the location, the place where you're at, the time of the day, your emotional state, maybe other people that are around you, and the actions that are directly before you start feeling that craving. So if you experiment a little bit and identify, you may find, gosh, you know, around 2 o'clock, I'm really tired. That's the cue. It's not really that I want a Coke, but it's I'm tired. So now we've identified the behavior that we want to change. We kind of link the reward and the craving together, and then we identify the triggers, the cues. And what the next step is to create these if-then kind of scenarios. They call it implementation, that will help you to move towards or away from the behavior that you're trying to change. For example, if I start to feel tired, what I'm going to do is get up and go take a walk rather than get up and go get a Coke. Now, you have to experiment with these, and it's not always going to work out. It may take some time. You have to stay vigilant with this, and you have to do the work. There's just no other way to change a habit. But this isn't rocket science, I'm telling you. We all have these particular associations in our brain, and if we can find them out, we can unlock those codes and change our behavior. So in using this, you may find the strongest thing for me is if I get tired or if I'm bored, I tend to go for the Coke. Well, if I get tired or I get bored, I am going to get up and go for a walk, and I may talk to some people who are working with me. And you come back and you see how you feel. And if the craving is less, you start to change. And really, you can see some amazing change occur. You know, the reward itself that we get, the payoff that kind of reinforces our behavior, it really isn't as important as you would think. The author of The Power of Habit talked about his own struggle with losing weight. And what he found was that he hated to exercise. Even though he told himself, exercise is good with me, I'm going to exercise, his body and his mind, he knew, I hate to exercise. So even though you know I want to get healthy, I want to lose weight, the way I do it is with exercise. Exercise is going to make me lose weight. If you don't like that reward of exercise, no weight is going to come off. So what did he do? He decided the thing he loves the most is chocolate. So what he ended up doing was that he would exercise, and instead of the reward being losing weight, he'd give himself a small treat of chocolate because that is always going to be positive for him. He'd go out, he'd exercise, just a little bit of chocolate, so that behavior, that cue, I need to lose weight, was always tied with a reward that was positive. I love chocolate. And slowly, the behavior became automatic. And here is the rub, and this has been proven in experiment after experiment. You can remove the reward at some point, and the behavior will continue. And all of us can relate to this when we maybe eat for no reason, or, you know, we shouldn't be spending that much time on the internet. But even though we're not even enjoying it, we continue. And we literally can remove the reward once the behavior is in place, and we will continue with it. Remember, when we crave something, the pleasure is already given to us by our brain. The behavior almost comes secondary to fill that gap between the trigger and the reward we've already felt. So you can pull the reward away like the author did, and he continued to exercise. He didn't need the chocolate there all the time because now he was getting reinforcement from the weight that he was losing. Now, one of the most important, if not the most important part of all of this, and really this goes for anything that we talk about here on The Healthy Mind, believe that you can change. That is so important. Picture it, see it in your mind's eye, and believe you can do it. You can. You really, really can. It really is much more basic. It's a process. Don't get me wrong. It takes some time, but we're the same in the way that these behaviors form. And if we can learn to deconstruct that habit loop and understand what influences us and what doesn't, well, then we know how we can change things. The habits will change. If you need help to do this, find someone. It doesn't have to be a counselor. Get a friend. Get a group. Go exercise together or lose weight with other people. But you can do it. You can do it. And when it starts to change, you start to get empowered. Oh, and then get ready for that positive change. You'll see it. When you do, you have taken an incredible step on your road to the healthy mind. And now, it's time for news. Okay, well, you know, it was another busy week of health news. This first story, for those of you that may be suffering with anxiety and depression, new news out of Vanderbilt University, which offers hope for the future. The headline, researchers discover a new way to treat stress and anxiety. Now, what researchers at Vanderbilt University had found was that chemically modified COX-2 inhibitors, you may have heard of COX-2 inhibitors, they're involved in anti-inflammatory actions, kind of like Celebrex and those types of medications. Well, chemically modified inhibitors of this enzyme relieve anxiety behaviors. And the reason that they do this is by activating natural, what are known as endocannabinoids. And these don't have any gastrointestinal side effects. That's a problem with some of these anti-inflammatory meds. They hurt your stomach. Now, what are these endocannabinoids? What are they all about? Well, they're naturally signaling molecules that activate the cannabinoid receptors in our brain. What's a cannabinoid receptor? Well, that is the receptor that gets stimulated when, if you do, not saying that you do, but if you do smoke marijuana or use marijuana, it is the active ingredient in marijuana that stimulates those receptors. Well, these receptors are found in the GI system and other places in the body, and there's evidence that they play a role in a wide range of biological processes, including modulating stress and anxiety. Now, this was an animal study. It was done in mice, but researchers are working to try and replicate these studies in human beings. And if it works in human beings without side effects, it could really open the doors to a whole new type of treatment in mood and anxiety disorder. This is what the researchers say. But according to the lead researchers, Dr. Lawrence Marnett and Dr. Sachin Patel of Vanderbilt University, clinical trials of these potential drugs could begin in the next several years. Now, this isn't just for anxiety. What they're finding, like I said earlier, is these receptors are everywhere in the body, and they're pursuing other potential applications of this system, including pain relief, treating certain movement disorders, and possibly treating colon cancer. According to Dr. Patel, we've just scratched the surface. The door is really wide open. Now, these very special forms of COX-2 inhibitors developed at Vanderbilt University don't affect the inflammatory system, the prostaglandin effect that we see in some of the medications that are already out there that work along this system to treat inflammation. So that's why they think that it won't have some of the cardiovascular effects or the GI effects. That was some of the danger of some of these meds like Bextra and Celebrex, because they had potential cardiac effects. Say nothing about the GI effects and upsetting your stomach. But it does represent some new hope as we look down the road of treating anxiety and mood. So this discovery at Vanderbilt University is very, very hopeful, and it really goes to prove the point that I talk about both here and in my practice. The science is always moving forward as it relates to anxiety and depression. If you haven't found what you need just yet, have hope for the future, because like this finding here at Vanderbilt University, the new treatments and approaches and our understanding of anxiety and depression could be just around the corner. Okay, now, since we've been talking about habits and how they form, how we make changes, I thought that this piece of health news was perfect for the podcast today. The story headline, How Insomnia Leads to Pizza Cravings. I don't know if you're anything like me, but, and I always thought it was just, I want to treat myself. I haven't slept well. I am just going to eat the comfort foods. But I really could relate to what they were talking about in this story. I feel like eating a hamburger or pizza or wings, something that's really maybe not so good for me, but that I really like. Well, it turns out our mind is programmed to lead us to those types of food choices when we haven't slept well. Can you believe that? It turns out insomnia literally primes your brain to crave that comfort food. Now, this was new research out of the University of California at Berkeley. And what the researchers found was that a sleepless night makes us more likely to reach for those fatty foods than it does for, say, whole grains or leafy green vegetables. They were doing a study on the brain regions that are in charge of controlling food choices. And what they did was take volunteers and put them under an MRI, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine. And what the researchers found was that there was impaired activity. The activity in our brain changed, particularly in our frontal lobe, that area of the brain that controls complex decision making when we're sleep deprived. And also, they found that there was an increase in activity in the deeper brain centers, the primitive brain that responds to rewards. So this is what they think is the reason why people will favor these unhealthy snacks and junk food when we're sleep deprived. According to Dr. Matthew Walker, the senior author of this study, quote, "What we have discovered is that high-level brain regions required for complex judgments and decisions become blunted by a lack of sleep, while more primal brain structures that control motivation are amplified." You know, this really goes to show how complex the mind-body relationship is. What you think is just a sleepless night isn't a sleepless night. The activity literally changes in your brain, decreased in the areas that maybe control your behavior to say, yeah, you know, you shouldn't eat that pizza, and increases in those areas where it says, yeah, oh yeah, I want that pizza with pepperoni, and throw the sausage on there as well. Those areas shift. So what we think in that we're making a completely free choice, like I said at the beginning, God, I just really feel like a hamburger when I haven't slept well, is much more than that. So the next time you're having problem with sleep or you haven't slept well, be careful. Your brain is programming you to love and eat that pizza. Okay. with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. MIT researchers reveal how the brain keeps its eyes on the prize. Researchers show how the brain remains focused on long-term goals. A new study from MIT suggests how the brain does this, and it indicates that the neurotransmitter dopamine may signal the value of long-term rewards. The next headline. An extra hour of TV beyond recommendation diminishes toddlers' kindergarten chances. Listen up, parents. Every hourly increase in daily television watching at 29 months of age is associated with diminished vocabulary and math skills, classroom engagement, victimization by classmates, and physical prowess at kindergarten. Watch that TV viewing. And finally, do you love chocolate? Oh man, I absolutely love chocolate, especially if it's strategically placed at 2 p.m. The headline, chocolate may help keep the brain healthy. Hallelujah. Drinking 2 cups of hot chocolate a day may help people keep their brains healthy and their thinking skills sharp. This, according to a new Harvard study published in the latest issue of the journal Neurology. Oh, yes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's just about going to do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Thank you as well for taking time to rate this podcast on iTunes. If you haven't done it already, I would love it if you could. Thank you as well for signing up for the newsletter. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis. The website, as always, thehealthymind.com. And any questions, comments, anything, I want to hear from you, please email me. I love the emails. You can reach me at peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.